This is the UK Energy Research Centre podcast.
Hello, welcome to Talking Energy, the UK Energy Research Centre podcast. My name's Rob Gross. I'm the director of the UK Energy Research Centre, and I'm joined today by Malika Iswaran, who's the chief economist of Shell. And we're going to be talking about scenarios.
Before we do that, Malika, could you say a little bit more about yourself, your role at Shell, and if you like, your journey, how you came to be doing what you're doing now?
Yes, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here, Rob. I'm chief economist of Shell and a member, privileged to be a member of the Shell scenarios team. So my sort of day job there is sort of decoding and paying attention to a lot of the external trends, particularly economic trends around the macroeconomy, around policy, and translating and interpreting that in terms of what it means for the outlook for the energy system, for various areas of interest for Shell. And so again, informing decisions within Shell. Also, it sort of feeds into how our long-term scenarios are built and sort of the insights that the economics, from the economics and policy side, how they're affecting the evolution and development of our long-term scenario outlooks, which we will talk a little bit about today.
We will. We'll come back to some of those things. You have the Shell as a company, has these kind of cool names for your scenarios like Green Dreams and Surfers and Sky. But I'm quite intrigued by the fact that when you click on the Shell website and you go into the kind of scenarios section of the website, a disclaimer pops up and says that, you know, don't invest on the basis of our scenarios, or they're not projections or something like that. So could you maybe just explain a bit, going back to the beginning, thinking about listeners not so familiar with the scenarios literature, what are not scenarios?
Yeah, so I think it's a tool that Shell has used within the company for more than 50 years. So it's a long tradition of using scenarios. And the purpose of those scenarios is to help us as a company make better decisions in the face of really sort of radical and fundamental uncertainties. So I think usually you talk about projections and forecasts, and you put sensitivities around them when you're talking about normal uncertainties, business uncertainties, market uncertainties. But if you have sort of systemic uncertainties like we are seeing today in terms of the evolution of the energy system, in terms of how particular aspects of that system are likely to evolve, then projections and forecasts become less useful. But anytime you put sensitivity bounds around those forecasts, they'll just swamp the forecast itself. So in the face of those kinds of uncertainties, the scenarios provide a really good way of thinking through and stretching your mindset to include the kinds of outcomes that might pan out over a course of, you know, decades that we're looking at here. And for a company like Shell, where a lot of the investments is upfront CapEx and the investments are long-lived, having that sort of understanding of what these longer-term uncertainties are, what are the mega trends we're seeing today, what are the critical uncertainties around how those mega trends might evolve, becomes quite fundamental. And having the scenarios then allows us to test our decisions, test our investment choices against those kinds of range of outcomes. And the hope is that that would then help us make more resilient and more robust decision in the face of that uncertainty. That's what the disclaimer says. There's a bit more nuance in terms of interpreting these scenarios than simply saying that that's your investment plan.
And it's not your, it's more of a thought experiment, I guess, in some respects, than a projection. And lots of different types of organization use scenarios now. You know, governments use them. They're used by international organizations like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the International Energy Agency. But Shell's, you already touched on this, but Shell's got a history of going back to the 1970s. And maybe you could tell us a bit about that. Is it true that they helped Shell to predict or anticipate the 1970s oil crisis?
So that is, so obviously it's before my time, so I'm happy to say that.
Yes,
they did. So I think they are they help think of things that are not in the immediate line of sight, if you like. to start anticipating things that might be developing, emerging, or might just come out of a little bit of, you know, out of your immediate line of sight. And so again, you know, things like the 1970s oil crisis, using the scenarios approach didn't tell you when the crisis was going to happen or what, you know, exactly what the spike is going to look like. But it told you that there were things, pressures building up that could lead to this kind of volatility. And that, again, helped the Shell be much better prepared, if you like, when it did hit, than possibly many of our peers and others. I think the same thing, again, we see in 2016, where we did our scenarios, which sort of looked at energy transition and sort of said, this is a trend that's not reversing. It's not a volatility issue. This is a trend towards low carbon. And again, that helped inform sort of Shell's 2016 decision to start developing energy transition strategies, start thinking, you know, sort of in a concrete and granular way about how those developments and that transition to low carbon, what it means for the company and what kind of opportunities as well as challenges it throws up. So again, you know, it sort of feeds into and helps us think beyond what's immediately in front to anticipate and to seize opportunities, I think, that are sort of more nascent, if you like.
So 2016, so we're leaving the 1970s behind for now, but let's just focus in on the more recent past. So 2016, you have a set of scenarios that were more focused on the transition, by which you mean the moving away from traditional energy sources towards renewables to kind of decarbonization trend. And that informed Shell's thinking about that. But your most recent set of scenarios, it seems to me, they're still about that. They're still about the energy transition, but they're about a bit more about uncertainty and energy security and geopolitics. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think our latest scenarios were released last year, and they call the energy security scenarios. And as the name sort of points out, that we sort of saw this emerging trend around security, sort of governments focusing in on that, whether that's in terms of economic security. So we saw these trends come after the 2008 financial crisis. There was a sense that how can countries make themselves more resilient to trends, global trends. In that case, it was around the financial system. Then you had the pandemic. And then again, the idea of sort of health security came. How do countries become more resilient to pandemic and sort of cross-border trends? And then you had Russia's invasion of Ukraine and energy security manifested itself. How do countries ensure that they have adequate supplies? So again, this sort of a trend towards an energy, but also a wider security focus, sort of maybe something we noted. And we were very interested to understand what does that mean for the starting point for the energy transition today? If that is the kind of lens that governments are applying, what does it really mean? And our initial hypothesis, to be honest, was that it may not be a good news story in terms of these kind of drivers could lead to a slowing down of the energy transition. But what we did when we did our two scenarios, Sky 2050 and Archipelagos, what we found actually that this energy security imperative is creating policy clarity and is actually adding, in some cases, to the drive towards decarbonization. Because, for example, we were looking at emerging and developing markets, which is where most of the energy demand growth is going to come from. And what we found over there is that there is a sense that countries wanted to pivot away from imported energy, and most times those imported energy was fossil, towards domestic energy sources. And most of those in the global south, most of those domestic resources are renewable. So again, on low carbon. And so again, you know, inadvertently, that energy security sort of imperative was also aligning up and driving the sort of low carbon and energy transition to low carbon trend. So again, it threw up quite a few interesting ways in which that was manifesting itself. And hence the archetypes you mentioned, the green dreams and the surfers, because we wanted to analyze countries and groups of countries sort of systematically to see how the energy security response is manifesting and how, what does that mean? And again, it ended up in two scenarios, which even the less optimistic scenario, Archipelagos, ends up with global temperatures stabilizing around 2.2 centigrade by the end of the century. So you know, again, there is the energy security imperative wasn't sort of as much of a hindrance as we'd initially hypothesized, and in fact ended up being creating pockets of accelerated action, in fact.
Okay, so let me just try and unpick some of that a little bit. So this, all the scenarios, different names, is probably quite difficult for us to keep on top of in a spoken format, you know, in a podcast. But in the scenarios, there's a certain amount of momentum that builds around technologies because low carbon technologies have gotten cheaper in the fairly recent past.
That's correct. Yeah.
And I think you expect that will self-reinforce to a certain extent. But it won't necessarily, self-reinforce to such an extent that governments don't need to do anything anymore and we can just, you know, not worry and we'll get to climate stabilization at an acceptable level. And so then your different scenarios are playing around with what kind of form of government intervention and how regional or national or international it might be. So is that all a kind of fair description? And then maybe just unpick that a bit for me about how they, archipelagos sound like a nice thing, right? Sounds like some beautiful islands, but in some respects it's got some negatives to it.
That's right.
Perspective. So yeah, sorry, carry on.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think what the energy security sort of starting point is also a world that's fragmenting more. And that's what we see around us. As countries become sort of a little bit more preoccupied with their own domestic sort of air security and other agendas and other issues, you are seeing this fragmentation of the global sort of economy and system. And again, you have part of both the scenarios that we have now released as part of energy security scenarios, both of them build off the fragmentation trend. But the difference between the two is that in archipelagos, the fragmentation sort of manifests in a more confrontational, in a more protectionist, if you like, way. So countries are competing with each other, but it's almost a race to the bottom in terms of, sort of putting in place protectionist measures that protect themselves from external sort of moves, external, drivers, factors. And that kind of competition actually ends up resulting in a lower or slower energy transition. Whereas Sky 2050, again, is fragmented. Countries and regions are competing with each other. But they're competing on the basis of innovation and who can provide the best product into the market. So it's a little bit more of a race to the top in terms of who is going to provide the best solar panel or who is going to provide the most efficient electrolyzer. And without the protectionist sort of measures, these technologies can be developed with the lowest cost inputs. So you can source inputs from wherever you want. And there are no restrictions in terms of where the output then goes. So there are no market restrictions in terms of where the final product then flows. And in that kind of world, without these restrictions, you find that the energy transition happens at a lower cost. And it happens as a result at a faster pace. It proliferates better. But without that kind of government intent, if there's a reversion to more sort of protectionist, more inward-looking sort of government approaches and policies, then that results in a more archipelagos, slower and more costly and more bumpy, if you like, transition to net zero.
And is either of the two scenarios differentiated by the extent to which governments are seeking to promote low carbon technologies specifically? Or so you talk about the one being more protectionist than the other, and that's therefore less innovative, slower growth, lower progress towards net zero. Presumably there's less interconnection and sharing of resources. Is any of them are more protectionist? Because you could be kind of protectionist in a Biden way, which is kind of a bit green protectionism. Or you could be protectionist in a more, another potential American president type of a way, which might be anti-green protectionism. Do the scenarios distinguish between those kind of or is it more to do with just the kind of level of free trade and protectionism?
So I would recast a little bit in terms of the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, which is what you were alluding to there. I think it has elements of both. So this is an example I always give, that scenarios don't give, you know, there are always elements of both scenarios in real life that you see. So I think the IRA has, as you say, it's very much supporting low carbon innovation, you know, the subsidies on the various technologies to drive them to commercialization, to deployment. These are all going to be a massive impact in terms of driving cost declines. And that benefits not just the US, but everyone in that sense. So in that sense, it's very much a Sky 2050 kind of race to the top competition. But I think there are elements in it, the Made in America components, that are very protectionist, very archipelagos, because that's restricting where your inputs come from, even if they raise costs. So it might be that you get your inputs from a particular country, which provides them at the lowest cost, but that's being ruled out because of, you know, whatever the protectionist urge is. And so again, you know, so even with something like the IRA, you're seeing both elements of Sky as well as archipelago sort of playing through. But I think in the net, we think that if you want to get to a Paris Agreement compliant scenario, you have to have the world more or less growing in the sky, competing on the best, providing the best product, rather than the more restrictive archipelago scenario.
That makes sense. And trading freely and trading energy and products without restrictions. I completely understand. In terms of your audience, because you talked a bit at the beginning about how Shell, and we talked about the example from the 1970s, about how the company uses these scenarios. And obviously the company employs you and your colleagues. You go and consult with people, and we'll talk a bit more about that, and produce the scenarios. But you also publish the scenarios. There's like loads of stuff on your website. It's a huge resource that you make available freely to anyone. Who is Shell trying to inform or influence? Is it governments?
Yeah. So to be honest, I think the primary purpose of the scenarios is to inform internal decision making. That's always been the mandate. It's about preparing the company for some of these uncertainties and to making sure we have plans in place to deal with them, whether on the upside or the downside. So both in both cases. I think there is a secondary sort of sharing it and putting it into the public discourse as a way of informing how, coming from the perspective of a company like Shell, how we see the transition, what kind of hurdles, what kind of accelerators are you going to see, how does it play out? So it's about contributing to that discourse also. But interestingly, now with the energy transition to low carbon, this is something that a company like Shell cannot do on its own. So we can produce all the low carbon energy supply we want, but you'd actually need demand transformation so that demand side is able to run off the low carbon energy molecules or electrons that are being produced. And also there's an issue of infrastructure that needs to be built up to move these new forms of energy around. So again, we're realizing that you need to be working with government who will have a lot of say in terms of creating the policy environment to transform demand, who create the environment for infrastructure investments. So again, it becomes more of not a nice to have, but it's almost you have to be in discussion with government in terms of how the transition unfolds and how our investments can actually pay off. And also dealing with our what we call our customers. But these are the people who use the energy that Shell currently provides. And sort of working with them to make sure that their transformation is in lockstep with what we're doing, so that demand matches supply and vice versa. So you're not having bottlenecks or market that where there is no demand for a particular product. So again, so we're finding that it's become more of a business need rather than nice to have with this transition, to talk to governments and to talk to other private sector players in other segments of the economy to make sure that then that our investments are viable and pay off over the long term.
Yeah, we've got this kind of critical path issue, haven't we, with the transition. Things need to move in lockstep. You know, obvious example, electric vehicles and electric vehicle charging infrastructure.
Exactly.
If those get out of sync, one's in front or behind, we've not got enough chargers, or we've got, and so on.
It's very different from a market, global market for oil or gas, you know, so it's fundamentally different because you've got a lot more players that you need to work with to make the change happen.
Yeah, I understand. So, I mean, following on from that, how does Shell go about producing these scenarios? I mean, so obviously there's a team within Shell. You've talked about them a bit, but I know a bit about this, so I'll I'll say that I know that you go out and it's quite deliberate. You talk to people, you engage with lots of stakeholders.
Yeah. I always say it takes a village, if not a small town, to produce these scenarios. So again, the scenarios team itself is configured to have sort of like deep expertise around the economics and policy, which is what I would be bringing, around energy systems, understanding that and the energy system modeling, on understanding climate science. So that's also another area of expertise. And also geopolitics. So there's a whole team that looks at geopolitics because energy is fundamentally affected by what happens in sort of overall geopolitical environment. So first of all, there's that expertise, all those different perspectives coming in as a starting point for thinking about what are the key mega trends that we see emerging in the world today. And again, by key, it has to be a handful or less mega trends. You can't have a laundry list of mega trends, because that just becomes unmanageable. So we really have, it's a lot of work distilling down into what we think are the key material megatrends that we see emerging. For example, now we're seeing technology, AI is one of those megatrends. You're seeing, sort of energy price volatility is a megatrend. And then on top of that, we layer on what are the critical uncertainties in terms of how these megatrends evolve. So where are the nodal points in terms of these megatrends, how are they going to manifest? So that a lot of that expertise starts internally, but then we reach out to a lot of external experts. So it could be academics, it could be people working in the business, sort of complementary business areas, or maybe in sectors that have had sort of where the change is a little bit of an analogy to for what we would be expecting in the energy sector. So we reach out to a whole host of thinkers, if you like, from different perspectives, to get the range of what they think is fundamental, what they think is important. We also, I mean, there's a lot of expertise within Shell, on deep expertise on many aspects of the energy system. So we reach out to those, even within Shell. And then I think back after that, the magic needs to start happening. When you really go out wide first, and then you start converging back down into what does this mean? When you have suites of scenarios, we usually have two. And maximum three. So you don't produce a whole range. So it's about converging all those insights to produce two or max three internally consistent scenarios. So if you're saying something on the energy system, that has to be consistent then with what the economics to support that, or that has to be then consistent with the kinds of geopolitics that you see play out. So for example, in the energy security scenarios, having a fragmenting world, that has to be consistent with how the trade flows move. That has to be consistent with how the geopolitics in terms of tensions between countries play out. So, so you have to coalesce all the insights that you've received into a set of internally consistent scenarios. And I think that really is where the Shell excels in bringing that together and putting it forward as deceptively simple, if you like, two scenarios, but with huge number of layers of insight that are all thought through and all built up in a way that's very intentional.
Yeah, it's like any very complex narrative, isn't it? In the world of drama or screenplay, there's an awful lot of thinking that goes into something that appears very straightforward is actually more complex. And on that, I know that you engage with a wide range of stakeholders, and you with environmental groups, and Shell is a fossil fuel company, amongst other things. So when you're engaging with, how does that work out? How do you go about engaging with those different voices? And what's the kind of points of controversy in the scenarios?
So as I said, the idea for us is not to take on arguments or to rebut. It's about putting forward and adding, hopefully enhancing, the discussion around what it takes to make this transition happen. So we have one voice in there, and I certainly expect that a voice from government is going to have a different take, a different perspective. A voice from an NGO will have a different perspective. And so I think the whole idea of this is that, from my perspective, that there's a social change when you're transforming the energy system. So you have to have all those different perspectives sort of feeding into how do you make that change happen? And I think Shell in the scenarios is one perspective that goes into the mix. And I think fully accept that, having the discussion out in the open and transparently is then allows for better decisions and better societal buy-in, I think, in terms of what is the pathway forward. I don't think there's one pathway that is the only one in terms of decarbonizing. We're going to have a range of sort of experiences, pathways, depending on the country you're in and the circumstances you have. So again, having that discussion means you, as long as you move towards a consensus and you make progress, then that's a win for Shell. And also the other thing is, if you have societal buy-in and and progress being made on the basis of that, for a business, it gives us more certainty. It gives us more policy certainty. It gives us more business certainty. And again, as I said, if you're investing for the long term, you're putting a lot of capex upfront, having that certainty again is a huge a boost. So again, what we want to do is contribute towards an open discussion that leads to something that has consensus and then gives us greater confidence to invest in it.
So leaving aside, you know, whether we get to 1.5 or 2 or, you know, where a scenario endpoint is, because that's really just a part of the story and a narrative. When you're discussing scenarios with external stakeholders, what are the most controversial aspects? So is it bioenergy? Is it the role of nuclear? Is it CCS? Or is it something else?
So I think lately, the big, and you've seen this, and you can see this play out over the, you know, with the COP, latest COP. I think the discussion, a lot of controversial discussions around what is the role of fossil fuels in the transition, right? And so again, particularly what's the role of natural gas and LNG in the transition, especially if you're trying to get out of coal, you're trying to move to renewables. And again, I think that is the most controversial because you can't, energy security-wise, you will still need some investments. At least that's our view. Even in a sky world, which is policy compliant, Paris compliant, you still need investments in oil and gas just to meet energy demand needs. And this is alongside to back up the sort of transition to low carbon that's happening anyway. So I think that's something where, you know, the energy security scenario speaks very clearly to that, that you have to provide energy security. Otherwise, you're going to lose societal sort of buy-in to do this. But at the same time, it's not a free-for-all in terms of, oil and gas demand. It's very much within the context of the world transitioning to net zero. But you still need some amount of fossil fuels to enable that and support that transition. I think that, to me, is the most fraught, probably, discussion externally, because, again, it has masses of nuances in it in terms of what do you mean by transition? How long is that transition? Different countries will have different sort of approaches to that. So again, and that speaks a little bit to CCS. Is it the way of keeping it in, fossil fuels in? Is it not? I mean, to me personally, I think, you know, you just need everything, every technology, whether it's bio or CCS or renewables or hydrogen. We just don't have the luxury, if you're going to reach anything near the Paris Agreement objective, don't have the luxury of sort of picking and choosing and saying which technologies and fuels or solutions you should use. We just need all hands on deck, all solutions in play, and with countries and choosing ones that suit them best, but not sort of ruling out things that might help the decarbonization journey. So I think, yeah, so to me, that's sort of my view, and that's the view the scenarios point out, that really this challenge is so large that having those kind of discussions, would distract from the fact that you need all of these technologies in some form, to some degree, different scales to be in play.
Yeah, it's the big challenge of trying to be one of the progressive oil and gas companies, right? There are those that are much less so, and in some respects, it's easier for them to be not engaging with the conversation. We're getting towards the end, but I'm imagining, so the sky scenario, I know we shouldn't necessarily describe scenarios as optimistic or less optimistic or good or bad, but the sky scenario is a scenario that is Paris compliant, net zero 2070. I think
2050.
It is 2050. Okay.
Yes.
And imagine that you are in the world, let's say 2070 anyway, because a bit beyond 2050. What's Shell doing in that world?
Yeah. Well, that's a good exercise of crystal balling there. But no, I think so. Shell has a target to be a net zero emissions energy company by 2050. So that is our ambition to do that. I think there are lots of uncertainties in terms of which technologies are going to be in play in which countries, in which geographies. And I think so there's lots of uncertainty. So I would be, I'll be wrong putting any sort of particular mix, if you like, of technologies, fuel solutions as being the right solution for Shell. I think this is something we're going to evolve and test out, invest, and figure out where is it that we have a competitive advantage, where is it that we have something to offer, some skills and some experience or some advantages. But I think, you know, I'm hoping that by 2050, by 2070, we'd be a company that's thriving. So we do have shareholders. We do want to be a profitable company. So you want to be thriving in 2070, but providing a very different mix of energy solutions, low carbon, and meeting our targets being net zero by 2050. So again, I don't know what exactly the mix that portfolio will look like, but I would hope it would be a profitable mix, because I think the company has a lot to offer in terms of supporting and investing the transition.
Okay. Are you optimistic about our, society or humanity's ability to navigate this transition?
So I'd say yes. I'm going to give a slightly long-winded answer on that to explain. So I'm yes. I think, I remember, I look back to 2006, and I remember when the Stern Review was first published, and I was in the UK government at the time. And if you look at just what's happened in 18 years since then, that, it's just a sea change. And I would say that in terms of technology, the energy system is pretty unrecognizable. I mean, you have massive renewables deployment going on. You have EVs taking off. And you are doing that not just in the advanced economies. China is leading the charge in doing all of this. You're seeing countries like India now picking up the baton, trying, moving with it. So I think in terms of the energy system changes you've seen in that just that short time, I think it's massive. I think more importantly than that, the societal change, attitudes towards what is climate change and the support for doing something around it has also really transformed. I remember questions in 2006 around, well, what is this climate change? What is the economics of climate change? And now you're getting questions when we go out with our scenario saying, yes, we know all that. What are you doing about it? So I think, it's a huge challenge. I think getting to Paris, it was rightly so, an ambitious objective to set the world. And in what way am I sort of taking away from the amount of effort that we need to put in to get there? But I think we also shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we've actually made, as a world and as humanity, made a massive unprecedented change in a very short amount of time already. And we just need to keep that in mind to inspire us to do more.
A very, very encouraging answer. The Nick Stern review of the economics of climate change that was published, was it 2006, 2007? Seems quite recent to me.
Duh.
But a huge amount has changed, as you rightly say, since then. Malachi Iswaran, Chief Economist of Shell, thank you so much for joining us. This has been the UK Energy Research Centre podcast, Talking Energy.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about UKERC, you can visit our website at www.ukerc.ac.uk.